I'll have the marshal call us to order again.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Reyes, Judge Ede, the Honorable Elise Larson presiding.
Thank you. You may be seated. For the audio record, today is February 21st, 2024. Today's argument is being live streamed, and there will also be an audio recording available within 24 hours. A reminder to those in the audience that no other recordings are permitted without the express permission of the court. With that, we have two remaining cases on our oral argument calendar, both before this panel. The first case is State of Minnesota versus Anthony, case number A22-0799. Good morning to both counsel. As I'm sure you're both aware, you will each have 15 minutes for argument this morning, and appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, counsel for appellant, if you're ready to proceed. And feel free to adjust the podium as necessary for your comfort.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant, Kevin Anthony. For today's argument, my focus is going to be on defense counsel's failure to challenge probable cause to arrest Mr. Anthony in the district court below, although I'm prepared to answer questions on any of the issues raised in my brief. No reasonable lawyer would forego pretrial litigation of a meritorious claim as featured in this case, as defense counsel did here. There was no probable cause to arrest Mr. Anthony. His defense counsel failed to do any legal research on that issue. And because he failed to investigate the law, any claim of strategy must be rejected. Defense counsel was ineffective because the police did not have probable cause to arrest Mr. Anthony for drug possession. Dickey lays out three factors that should be evaluated in discussing constructive possession of drugs found in an area that's occupied by multiple people. And none of those factors are present here. The drugs were not found in an area where there was any indication Mr. Anthony had been. There's none of Mr. Anthony's belongings are found in the motel room, no ID, no paperwork. There's no clothing of a male that's found in the room. And the only person who possessed the drugs on that day was SS.
You would agree, though, that if we agree with you on this argument on the drugs, the PC for drugs being lacking,
yep,
that if we were to find that there was PC to arrest for promoting prostitution,
yep,
then that would be an independent basis to affirm?
Correct. We have to succeed on both of those arguments in order to succeed on our argument that the phone, the money, and the key card are all suppressible and would not have been accessible to the state.
That's because it's an objective analysis. It doesn't matter that there was not actually an arrest for the promoting prostitution.
Correct.
If the facts existed objectively.
Yes.
So the reason why I ask you that is that there's a few references in your brief to Officer Bartle, Bartolo's subjective analysis of what was going on and some subjective decisions that were made before the decision to arrest for narcotics rather than to ever arrest for promoting prostitution. If it's an objective analysis, should we put any emphasis on those subjective decisions?
Yes, because there's a case that's cited in the state's brief, and unfortunately it's not in my brief, Lester, that talks about evaluating the totality of the circumstances and says that this court should rely on the reasonable inferences that police officers draw from facts based on their training and experience, because police officers may interpret circumstances differently than the untrained person. And so here we do have an officer who is involved in prostitution stings. We know about all his actions leading up to them putting Mr. Anthony in handcuffs, and we know that the statements that Officer Bartola made at the scene about telling the front desk person that she is prostituting herself and that he's with her, but doesn't make a reference to they're both working together.
She made the reference that she made the statement that he's my boyfriend.
Yes.
He's familiar with how prostitution works in terms of how the person being prostituted often refers to the person in control of that situation they refer to them as their boyfriend. It seems like there's quite a bit of extensive evidence to support the prostitution charge here. You've got the call to the phone that right up to the very minute before they met them, the photo, they were standing together, the fact that he, you know, said, you know, don't let them anywhere, you know, soldier up, you know, don't say anything. It looks like there's quite a bit of evidence to support probable cause.
Well, Officer Bartolot didn't think so, because when he was asked by his other officer.
But it doesn't really matter, because we just look at the objective. The fact that he told them he's being arrested for drug possession doesn't preclude, as you acknowledged earlier, the fact that there can still be probable cause to arrest them for another. If there's probable cause to arrest them for another charge, that alone is sufficient, correct?
We would agree that there were suspicions that Officer Bartola had of potential involvement with prostitutions, and some of the things that you've named qualify as suspicions, but it doesn't rise to the level of probable cause.
What was the point you were going to make about when asked by another officer?
Yeah, he was asked by another officer, what do we have to arrest him on? And the officer said, only for smoking. And then they took him out of handcuffs. And they didn't gain additional information linking Mr. Anthony to SS's prostitution activities in between the time he was taken out of handcuffs and the time that he was arrested a second.
I think we do.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think we do. When they went into the hotel room, they found a drawer full of condoms. She acknowledged that the two of them were in the room together. It was just those two, but then a third person came in. There was the drugs that were obviously found. The officer said, you know, drugs often go with prostitution because that's how they control the person who's being prostituted. So it wasn't just up to the time that they released him from handcuffs. There's actually evidence after that would support the probable cause.
Well, the condoms only support that she was prostituting herself, and she told the officer right away, one of the first things she said to the officer is she admitted to being prostituted, or that she was being a prostitute. She also was very clear to the officer on multiple times that he didn't even know that she was acting as a prostitute. So, you know, we don't have any information.
Right, but the officers are trained to discern whether or not somebody is actually being truthful or not.
Yeah.
In the video, it's very clear that the officer keeps asking her over and over about that.
Yeah, based on his suspicions. Not enough for probable cause, but based on his suspicions. He had suspicions, obviously, that Mr. Anthony was involved. There's reasons to be suspicious, but the...
Well, I think there... But we're looking at the totality of the circumstances here. And you look at all that the information, it seems to be... And the probable cause is a much lower burden than beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct. And he also could just be a possessive boyfriend. You know, he doesn't have, just because somebody calls somebody their boyfriend, they could actually be their boyfriend. There's no indication here of, at least based on her statements, of him actually being her pimp.
Right, but then that's ignoring the evidence of they were actually participating in an operation to, basically a sting operation.
Yep.
For prostitution, all the information that they had beforehand.
Yep.
Also the fact that he had, when the officer was texting, he was getting responses back. She did not have a phone. He had a phone.
The officer never never put in his police report that he saw Mr. Anthony with the phone while he was texting with this person. We don't know if the phone switched hands in the time while Officer Bartella was walking.
But they separated the two. They were
correct.
Talking to two separate officers.
Yes.
And when they let him go, the appellant made the comment about the phone,
yep.
Basically saying you're not going to get your hands on it. Keep your eye on the prize.
Yep.
So
he also didn't say that he had prostitution-related activities on the phone or anything else. There's no other admission. All those statements were made before they took him out of handcuffs. And if you look at Lester and you look at the inferences that officers make versus the inferences that the judges are making now, is the inferences based on the officer's evaluation of everything that had gone on was that that's not why they're arresting him. And if you look back at the videotape and you look at my brief, at the time he's arrested, the officers arrest him for possession of drugs.
But
they don't say we're arresting you because we finally found
that's
the
immaterial
key.
Because that's we look at it objectively, not what the subjective comments are.
I understand that. But we also look at Lester, which says that
but
we have to look at the inferences of the officers.
Isn't the point that you're trying to make that the officers who are trained in these types of investigations did not think that they had probable cause to arrest him for prostitution? Isn't that really what your argument comes down to?
That's what it comes down to. Also, we also am arguing that based on the objective facts that they only had suspicions that he was involved in prostitution, but they didn't have objective facts that would establish probable cause.
And can you just clarify in with respect to what the officers said after the arrest? What is the record in terms of, you know, sort of post, you know, in these post-conviction proceedings? What is the record in terms of whether those officers still think that they, whether they had probable cause at the time of this arrest?
Well, when they arrested him, the officer said that they're arresting him for drug possession. And that Bardella says to the other officer, essentially, now that we found these drugs in this hotel room, that we now have enough to establish for arresting him for drugs. They do not say we're arresting him for prostitution or we found additional corroborating facts in the hotel room. And importantly, when you look in the police reports, and this again is in my brief, but the officers specifically, when Bartola writes up probable cause later for prostitution, he relies on the money that's found on Mr. Anthony, and he relies on the fact that he had called the phone and linked Mr. Anthony's phone to the prostitution ad. And that's really the only time where we have...
And both of those happened after the arrest for drugs.
Correct. Those were both found during the arrest for drugs.
You would really agree... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Aren't you really asking us... You're kind of turning Lester on its head here, right? Lester says that the court can rely on reasonable inferences that the police officers draw in determining whether there's probable cause, right?
Yep.
It doesn't say that if an officer makes a determination that there are no reasonable inferences to arrest someone at the time, then the reviewing court is now somehow, prevented from considering the facts that the officer might not have considered form probable cause. I mean, it seems like your argument is that, a court looking at the probable cause issue would be precluded completely from considering the facts that Officer Bartola didn't think amounted to probable cause apparently at the time, because Officer Bartola didn't think it amounted to probable, didn't arrest him for that, didn't put it in the PC statement that went with the complaint. So therefore, you could never charge him with it. You could never arrest him for it. I mean, isn't that the logical extension of what you're asking us to hold here?
That I would say that I'm not arguing that. I'm just arguing what Lester says and that you should evaluate that in evaluating the objective facts. Ultimately, you have de novo review of the objective facts.
What inferences were, not if he didn't draw an inference. You're asking us to evaluate something that Officer Bartola didn't draw. It said
he didn't draw it because there wasn't enough to draw, is what I'm saying. Is that the
cases that say that this kind of analogous cases to this nexus of facts wouldn't be enough for PC for promotion of prostitution?
Well, each probable cause case is so unique in its facts, except for, drug possession cases. But I did an extensive research on probable cause to arrest for prostitution, and there just really isn't anything out there. I think that, that's why it's helpful to look at the officers' inferences here and the things that they did and said in order to help guide this court at looking at the objective facts where there is suspicion of prostitution, obviously, because of, some of the things that Bartola says and the facts here, but it's not enough to establish probable cause.
Some of the things you're raising, right, in response to Judge Reyes's questions are that classic, well, there's an innocent explanation for this particular piece of evidence. There's, maybe she handed him the phone right before they walked up. Maybe someone else took the pictures of her that were posted. Maybe when he's making these statements, the soldier up, and she's calling him the boyfriend, he's just actually the boyfriend. I mean, we have cases that establish that even though there might be innocent explanations for pieces of evidence, there still can be in its totality, as Judge Reyes was asking you, a probable cause finding, right?
Well, and Officer Bartola, who ultimately, took him out of handcuffs and let him go and then later arrested him for drugs, went through, he obviously wasn't thinking these are innocent explanations. He's making the inferences that you want to make too here. And based on those facts, he didn't find that he had enough, to establish probable cause to arrest him.
But you're not answering Judge Eade's question. The question is whether we review based on the totality of the facts, not an objective standard, not whether he subjectively thought he had enough at that time to arrest.
I agree 100%. In my brief, I argue that this is an objective determination. I just think that the court has to look at all of the facts, the totality of the circumstances, and look at the inferences, you know, that the officer made under Lester.
When we're evaluating the, you know, this objectively, what weight, if any, do we give to the expertise of the officer, right? Because usually this happens in the inverse, right? Like, yep. Usually we're looking at these cases and the officer has said there was probable cause, and I certainly think that we have case law where we've said, you know, the officers have particular expertise that they've gained from their training and their experience. How do we weigh that in terms of, or what is the proper standard for weighing officer experience when we are looking at this from an objective perspective?
Well, again, I think that, you know, you often weigh that experience against my clients, and that the same rule should apply in favor of my client.
So you agree, so you would say that when we're looking at the objective test, we do still consider the expertise of the officer, and that whether that's favorable or not favorable to the appellant shouldn't matter in terms of our looking at officer expertise.
Yeah, and that's what I believe Lester should be read in conjunction with the objective test for probable cause.
Judge Larson, if I may ask one more question. The last question I wanted to ask is that, isn't it true, though, that we are actually reviewing the post-conviction court as to whether or not it abused its discretion, and it did find that there was probable cause, that the officers had probable cause, sufficient probable cause to arrest under the prostitution charge, correct?
Yep, and that's okay. De novo review by this court over the post-conviction court's determination of whether there was probable cause to arrest, and the Supreme Court has also said that the review of ineffective assistance of counsel is also based on de novo review by the appellate court.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, feel free to adjust the podium. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. So appellant, in his briefing, through a few different claims, attempts to establish that he should receive a new trial. However, when this court reviews the facts of this case under the applicable law for each of his claims, it demonstrates that appellant received a fair trial and his convictions should be affirmed. Since appellant focused on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, particular to the probable cause for arrest, that's where I will begin as well, although like my opposing counsel, I am happy to answer any other questions about any of the other issues. Appellant here received competent and effective assistance of counsel. Appellant argues that his counsel should have raised these suppression motions pre-trial. However, those motions would have been denied, and therefore counsel was objectively reasonable in not raising meritless motions on behalf of his client. I think it's important to keep in mind that this isn't purely this court reviewing probable cause. This isn't a review of any suppression motion because no suppression motion was made. Here, where the posture is reviewing for ineffective assistance of counsel, under Strickland, that's a very high bar that appellant needs to meet. Counsel is given a lot of deference, and there's a strong presumption of reasonableness in his decisions.
One of the places you ask us to defer to trial counsel is the decision to wait until trial to ask the testifying officer about the phone issue, turning on the phone. And the way I read your brief, it sounds to me like the state is, in this situation, approving of an argument that essentially amounts to a play toward jury nullification, right? Trying to get the jury to think that there was some unfair procedure that happened, and raising an issue to challenge the way in which evidence was gathered during trial rather than at a pretrial motion, which counsel is required to do. Why was it reasonable for counsel to, if counsel decided before trial that there was no merit to these motions and didn't do any legal research because he didn't want to, make any extra work for himself, then why was it reasonable for him to then try to ask about that during trial, when essentially that really is just trying to, nullify the jury in his client's favor?
So I would say counsel didn't do any additional legal research because he understood Fourth Amendment law, and he understood he's a very experienced criminal defense attorney, as we established through the post-conviction hearing. He knew the law. He had received all the discovery. He had reviewed the body cam and the police reports, so he knew what kind of transpired with seizing the phone and the officer powering it down and then the officer turning it back on and calling a number. And so based on the trial attorney's knowledge of the law and knowledge of the facts, pre-trial, he determined that it wouldn't result in any suppression of evidence for him to make that motion pre-trial. So my argument is that was reasonable. So then it was also reasonable that during trial, for his trial strategy to be to poke holes in the state's case, to challenge the officer's investigation, to try to demonstrate to the jury that, there were problems with this investigation in whatever way he could. And, I think trial counsel at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing testified that, his client was sitting next to him at trial, whispering in his ear, talking to him throughout the trial. And so there was a part of it where his performance was a bit, to appease his client and to do what his client was asking him to do, and one of which was to challenge the phone.
Right. Well, his client was making those same whispers in his ear pre-trial, too, and saying, I want you to move to suppress this evidence, right? Yep. So, I guess my concern is if we need to reach this issue about the decision to do this during trial, don't you have some concern about us approving of a trial strategy that essentially is to either A, appease the client, or B, try to nullify the jury?
I don't think you need to get that far. I think you can simply find that it was objectively reasonable for him to not raise a suppression motion pretrial that would have not resulted in any benefit to his client. And then, however trial counsel proceeded during the trial with his questioning of the officer on the stand, I think, it is trial strategy. I'm not going to, I represent the state. I'm not going to comment too strongly on I'm not going to endorse necessarily his trial tactics, but I don't think there was anything wrong with that once he was there and with the evidence.
Is it really trial strategy to not bring claims on the basis or on the argument that he was asking for a speedy trial? I mean, I don't see those as mutually exclusive, particularly under the facts here.
Sure. Well, I think under the facts here, trial counsel felt that to bring a suppression motion, that the only result would be a possible delay of trial. And I think that's what the testimony says at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. He just strongly believed that the suppression motions were fruitless. It wasn't going to result in any, it wouldn't change the outcome of the evidence presented at trial. And so all it could merely do, and I think what counsel candidly said in the hearing was, he has kind of raised those kinds of issues pretrial as a bit, possibly as a delay tactic, or that's kind of the only reason to bring a meritless claim or a meritless motion, is to possibly push the trial date out further. And when his client was telling him, I'm on a speedy trial, because his client thought that this case would be dismissed before it actually went to trial, and so he wanted to get out.
I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the cell phone, because in the situation here, appellant asked the police officer to shut off the phone. He did.
Mm-hmm.
But then the officer turned the phone back on.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that a search?
Sure.
Under the Constitution.
So, we look at...
And then I should add, then he dialed the number that he had before and then heard it ring.
Right.
But turning on the phone, why isn't that a search? And maybe a better question is, isn't there a colorable argument that his trial attorney could have made that actually was a search of his phone?
So there's a few things I want to say, so I'm trying to pick the order I want to say it in. You know, I think as to the colorable argument piece, one point I want to make, because we're under the guise of an ineffective assistance claim, is that it can't be objectively unreasonable. We can't hold that it's objectively unreasonable for counsel to raise a claim that is colorable, is thin, and is not clear under the law as we have it now. He would essentially be trying to break new ground in Fourth Amendment law by raising this issue, litigating this issue, and so I think he could have tried. I don't know if he would have been successful, as I argue in my brief, and I can elaborate on that, of why it's not a search. But I think just under Strickland, we can't hold that, this court shouldn't hold that it's objectively unreasonable to not raise a claim that isn't well established or clear under the law and would be a new argument. The reason I don't believe it was a search is when appellant was arrested, the phone was on. So when the officer seized the phone, incident to that arrest, it was on. And so the home screen was visible to the officer. The officer then complied with appellant's request to power it down, and he did. So I don't believe then later, pressing the power button again back on, that appellant could have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his home screen when it came into the officer's possession, it was on. So I don't think if the officer hadn't complied with appellant's request to turn it off, there would be no search question at all.
But why isn't that like, you know, the officer pulls someone over, the car door is open, the defendant says, I don't give you consent to search my car, close my car door. And then the officer then, you know, there's no plain view of anything in the car, but the officer then decides, I'm going to go reopen the car door, and now in plain view there's contraband, a gun or something. I mean, the defendant in that situation has said, I do not grant you consent to look inside my car. I am affirmatively telling you don't do it, and the officer complies and then does the opposite later. So why would that situation be different?
Well, I don't think when someone's arrested and then, you know, items are seized incident to that arrest, you know, that consent is the exception that we would be operating under. But I can also move on to...
That was the whole point of, right, the Supreme Court's line of cases, and the name is escaping me now, but you can't just search a phone as a search incident to arrest because of all the information it contains.
Sure, right? Sure. So then I can move on to why, you know, just pressing the power button to kind of get it back to the status quo of what it was when it was seized. He didn't... So under Barajas, in that case, you know, the officer opened a flip phone, manipulated the keys to gain access to the internal information stored within the phone to then view photographs that were stored in that phone, and that constituted a search. Here, you know, it's just a power button, didn't manipulate the phone in any other way, didn't access anything beyond the kind of public view of the home screen, and then took his own phone, the officer's phone, and dialed a number that he had gotten from the prostitution ad.
The distinction is fewer keystrokes then on the phone, basically, and that results in no Fourth Amendment search?
I think under Barajas that is what that case says. I can try to find, I had some notes on it.
Can I just ask a hypothetical? If the officer had gotten this phone turned off, do you think it would be a different question? If the phone was turned off at the time of the arrest, do you think that this would be a different question?
I think possibly, because I think under the kind of analogy to a closed container, I think a powered down phone is more analogous to a container that is closed. And so opening it to search inside, that's established as being a search. I think but because it was on, it does change the facts a bit. And the post-conviction court, you know, agreed with that.
I just was wondering, on the arrest issue, I know you argue it differently in your brief, but would you agree that there was no evidence of exclusive control by Mr. Anthony of the hotel room. So the question is, was there evidence that he exercised dominion and control over the actual pill bottle itself? And would you agree, at the very least, that your better argument is as to the PC to arrest for promoting prostitution, since it's pretty thin as to his dominion and control over that pill bottle and what's inside, right?
I agree that there is probable cause for both charges. I think the officer was being careful in not arresting on the basis of the promoting prostitution at that point because he knew there was more investigation to do. But I think under the objective facts and the reasonable inferences that we can gain from the police reports of, you know, how he knows what boyfriend can mean, he, you know, observed the victim's demeanor and that she appeared afraid of appellant. Kind of all of the totality of the circumstances combined, I think a lot of those same facts go to both the constructive possession of the drugs as well as the promoting prostitution. But I take your point, and I certainly believe there's probable cause on the promoting prostitution in this case.
Can you respond to the question I asked appellant in terms of how do we look at, you know, police officer expertise in this context where it is sort of a case flipped on its head? And so if this was a case where he had been arrested for prostitution, I think you would be standing up here saying the officers have experience and understand what are the, you know, tells for that this is actually a prostitution sting and he's not really a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
How are we supposed to analyze that when it's the flip side? And here we have an officer who didn't think that they had enough for probable cause to arrest for prostitution, and how should we weigh that in our objective mm-hmm. analysis?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can still look to the officer's reasonable inferences and what he knew based on his training and experience as to the tells of what is, a pimp and prostitute relationship, which I think he, in his mind in the moment, was gearing that towards the constructive possession of the drugs, of why appellant was linked to that room and how drugs play into prostitution. So, I mean, I think you still use that in gathering your objective view of the facts, and then I think it becomes, or in your gathering of the facts, and then it becomes an objective view of the elements. Because I think also, you know, officers are working in real time. It's late at night. They have a lot going on. So I think, you know, if they're thinking about the drugs, that's where they're going to go, and then he's keeping in his head that he's going to further his investigation on the prostitution.
But wasn't this initially a prostitution case? I mean, it seems a little odd to say the focus of his investigation was on the drugs when obviously this initial investigation was about prostitution. It wasn't about drugs. And so
sure.
Doesn't it seem a little incongruous to say that all of a sudden his investigation became a drug investigation, not a prostitution investigation?
No, and I guess I don't necessarily mean that. I see my time is up. But, you know, I would just say in the moment, as things were unfolding, the main focus was gathering a case for the prostitution. And then in that moment, the probable cause for arrest focused on the drugs at that moment in the course of their larger investigation.
Does anyone else have any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Defense counsel's strategy here was, I don't want to make more work for myself. Okay, his strategy was not any of the other things he said, and they were not incongruous with each other, as Judge Reyes pointed out. And there's actually a case that I found this morning. I apologize I didn't provide it to the court earlier, but it's Branch v. State, 2021, Westlaw 79927. Now, there's not a holding on this, but in that case, defense counsel requested a contested omnibus hearing to determine whether stop, search, and seizure were valid, and also demanded a speedy trial. And the district court satisfied both of those requests and set one on for February 22nd, 2018, and the jury trial on for March 13th, 2018. So there's nothing in the rules that say you can't ask for both. This is not strategy. The district court's legal determination that this is strategy is just, it's false, it's made up.
But to be fair to trial counsel, I mean, that quote in isolation, not making more work for himself, can sound bad, but at the same time, We now have a district court who's looked at this and said, no, there was PC to arrest, there's no ground to move to suppress the phone, you know, turning the phone back on. I mean, you could just as easily interpret that as counsel was saying, look, I'm not going to chase after dragons that aren't there, or tilted windmills, I think is the saying, right? And so I'm not going to make unnecessary work and do this. I mean, the fact is there really isn't an on-point case that says turning on a phone in this way, right, is a search, nor is there a case that you've been able to point to on the PC for prostitution that this kind of nexus of facts does not amount to probable cause. So why isn't that reasonable?
Well, first, I want to make sure that the court is aware that there's different things that are winnable based on the PC and the turning on the phone. If there's no PC, they never get the phone. They don't, search warrant later doesn't matter. So if I went on PC, they never get the phone, they never get the contents of the phone. That's the most damaging evidence here. No competent attorney would look at this case and say, yeah, I should really go speedy trial and try to go to trial with all this damning evidence that comes out of the phone and linked to the phone. So, and I think this court can also look at the PC cases I cited on drug cases, and they're overwhelmingly in my favor that there's not PC to arrest for that. And counsel wants to point out that the officer was being extra careful by only arresting him for the drug charge. There's no PC for the drug charge. So if he's not being careful for that, why should we say that he was being extra careful on the prostitution charge? He didn't think he had probable cause for the prostitution charge because there weren't objective facts here that supported the prostitution charge.
Well, counsel, I think the state outline in their brief outlines at least a dozen different facts that seem to support probable cause for the promoting prostitution charge, far more than the drug charge. So even if we were to agree with you on the probable cause for the drug charge, there seems to be more than ample evidence to support the probable cause for promoting prostitution. And we are looking at this from the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel in addition to, you know, we've got kind of multiple layers here. Abuse of discretion by the post-conviction court, the Strickland standard of reasonableness, and there's a strong presumption of reasonableness. So there's several layers that you have, burdens you have to overcome here.
Yeah, and you know, again, it's de novo review, and I would say that, you know, in evaluating this, you know, if you look at Nix and let's see if I have the other case, but Nixon, at least one of their cases, if you don't do any research at all and you don't do any investigation, we don't call something strategy.
Well, actually, I want to stop you there on the research, because the case law, including the Barajas case, talks about how the lack of research is only an effective claim if it's combined with ignorance on the part of the attorney. And
yep.
Here we have a very, very experienced, decades of experience, public defender, who was, you know, well-versed in the law and well-versed in the facts here. So the lack of research on its own doesn't seem to get you there.
An attorney is more versed or more experienced than I am, and I picked this up from the trial record that this was a bad search and was able to then order all these documents and get all these documents into court, the documents that he reviewed, and he was unable to make this real basic thing because he doesn't like to add any extra work for himself. Let's listen to what his strategy is and find that it's not strategy, and make an evaluation based on the probable cause record here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the time prescribed by statute. Counsel for the next case can approach.